Good evening. This is Life Rattles CKLN Story Show. I'm your host, Victoria Martinez. Tonight on Life Rattle number 1165, this is also our second to the last show here on CKLN, and since this is probably my last broadcast, I will be playing three of my favorite Life Rattle stories. One of my favorite stories on Life Rattle was written by Jeff Thomas. Jeff and his family live in Mississauga. Last we know, he has two young daughters. He attended a teacher's college at OISE and had hoped to return to his alma mater, the University of Toronto at Mississauga, to teach writing. Jeff told us he owes a great deal of thanks to all the professors in the PWC program, where he learned to write powerfully, embrace risk, and violate convention. Here is From a Mountaintop by Jeff Thomas. You are listening to Life Rattle on CKLN.
From a Mountaintop by Jeff Thomas. I encountered Savas Saglam, a resident of Kushadasi, Turkey, in a beach bar in Koh Samui, Thailand. The night we met, we slurped rum-drenched drinks, fought furious games of backgammon, and admired phosphorescent jellyfish during a midnight swim. We explored every beach and closed every bar on the island. When Savas went home to Turkey, I was just beginning to learn how to pronounce his name, Sawesh. When I arrived in Kushadasi 4 months later, my old friend, who works as a tout at his uncle's pension, introduces me to places and parties favored by the Turks, private beaches, after-hour bars, and uncharted biblical ruins. Sawesh knows the undiscovered hotspots, still unmentioned in the Lonely Planet guidebook. After a week exploring the rapidly touristed sites of Ephesus, Artemis, and Selçuk, it is time to see the rest of Turkey. I buy a bicycle and plan to ride down the Aegean coast, then swing around to see the northern shore of the Mediterranean. I hope to see Turkey's authentic underbelly, the places the tour bus misses. In Izmir, with the help of Sawesh, I purchase a cheap 10-speed bike, kiss my friend on both cheeks, and pedal out of Kushadasi. It's okay. A mid-sized city famous for its Ottoman-era mosques is my first day's destination. Halfway to Soke, I detour through Dilek National Park, a rocky peninsula jutting into the Aegean Sea. My gas station bought map indicates a dotted line leading out of the park. Dotted lines, I soon discover, are not paved. They are not even dirt. For 10 kilometers of rugged terrain, I walk with my bike on my back, stumbling down the slope. Two ancient men, smoking outside a small cafe, stare in astonishment as I enter Soke from the hills, cursing and sweating, a bicycle draped over my shoulder. The hardscrabble flatlands surrounding the cities of Milas and Mula provide little reason to snap a photo. I make 100 kilometers, a good two-day distance for an out-of-shape backpacker, but the only notable sights are thundering lorries and withered olive trees. This is a lot of work for little aesthetic payback. Bodrum and Marmaris, two of Turkey's most beautiful coastal villages, detour 40 kilometers off the inland highway. I balk at an 80-kilometer diversion, but no obstacle will stop me from seeing Fethiye, one of the most famous seaside destinations on the Mediterranean. No obstacle except the Taurus Mountains. I sit, sad and exhausted, at the bottom of a large mountain. At the bottom of a large mountain, I have no intention of scaling on a second-hand 10-speed. Hitchhiking is my only option. But I am limited to a vehicle big enough to accommodate my bicycle. A huge truck, almost as high as it is long, groans to a stop. Like a virgin, blares from the driver's side window. The middle-aged driver stops singing long enough to point to the back. An instruction to climb aboard. The truck is 15 feet high. I cannot even see what's on top. Hauling my bike, I clamber up the side, reach the uncovered top, and gaze down at sacks and sacks of potatoes. The spud truck labors up the mountain in first gear, little more than a jog. 45 minutes later, we reach the summit. It is cold. There is no vegetation, just rocks. Each rock, from pebble to boulder, wears a coat of powdery snow. When the truck stops, I scramble down, wave away the driver, and absorb the mountain pass. White-topped peaks rise from every direction. The crisp air shocks my lungs. The remoteness shocks my senses. "Wow," I whisper to nobody. 20 minutes later, pass before another vehicle. A rusted Fiat limps by. I tighten the nuts on my tires and brakes. It took nearly an hour to get up here. I'm unprepared for the flight to the bottom. I roll away, pedaling lightly. I pick up speed. I pick up more speed. I round a sharp turn, gulp, and stare straight down. There's no time for fear, no time to consider the terrain. At 60 kilometers an hour, I slalom down the mountain course. My frozen fingers hover over the brakes, but to apply them at this velocity would send me tumbling down the mountain. Every 500 feet, the road curves, forcing me to lean 45 degrees into the bend at top speed. This is crazy. I'm going to die. I see the truck that ferried me to the top of this roller coaster. He is descending in low gear, traveling 20 kilometers an hour. I pull out into the oncoming lane and whiz by, like he's standing still. If he waved, I did not see it. I certainly did not wave back. My suicidal sprint lasts 7 minutes. 7 insane and exhilarating minutes. I held my breath the whole way down. At the bottom, I sit on a rock and replay my life that had just passed before my eyes. The truck tilts around the last turn and rumbles toward me. We exchange looks. The driver's eyes bulge. I have become a story he will pass on to a future generation of Turks. The bottom of this mountain is the base of the next mountain. I ride for 10 minutes before the grade grows too steep. I stick up my thumb. An enormous tractor, towing a trailer of dirt, shudders to a stop. The oversized back tires are 6 feet high. The mustachioed farmer's nose, lips, and chin cower under a ferocious attack of facial hair. The tractor has one occupied bucket seat. I do not know if this Turkish Tom Selleck is offering me a ride or just stopping to gawk. Any hint of expression hides beneath his mustache. He motions to the tire, covered by a steel casing. He wants me to ride on the tire. I chuck my bike into the dirt and leap onto the tractor. The tire shield is about the size of an average writing desk. Perched 7 feet in the air, I begin my journey up the mountain atop a tractor wheelbase. The going is slow, but the view is spectacular. The right side of the road falls straight down. Down below, crumbling stone walls guard small farmhouses. It's impossible to tell what grows here. The only thing sprouting from the ground are rocks. I also begin to appreciate the fate that would have befallen me had I missed one of those downhill turns on my bike. When we reach the top, the farmer pulls over and turns off the engine. His eyes smile as he sweeps his arm across the panoramic vista. This is his country, his gesture says. Not just Turkey, but this region, these mountains. We both marvel at the majestic mountains. I suspect he would have stopped even if he were alone. The farmer pulls out a bag of pistachios from his frayed coat. We watch the sun set behind the mountain range. The only sound, the crackle of the empty shells. The tractor's faint light guides us down the other side. I still have to find a city, and then a place to sleep. Halfway down, I notice lights burning on the flat land below. My farmer friend instinctively recognizes my anxiety. He makes a signal I identify as, "Don't worry," followed by the international sign for sleep, praying hands, palms together, pressed against his ear. At the bottom of the hill, the driver turns off the main highway onto a gravel road. Soft light from a scattering of cottages appears every 10 minutes, a warm beacon on a pitch-black night. The tractor's dim light tracks only 6 feet, but the driver calmly negotiates the tight turns. Finally, the tractor slows in front of a house with a single light burning in a window. As I climb down, I hear unmistakable squeals of children who have missed their father. I stand sheepishly in the dark, my shaking body remembering the rumble of the giant back tire. "Come, come," my friend calls to me in Turkish. We sit around a worn but warm table. A little boy maneuvers to sit beside me, and a baby girl crawls onto my lap, and a smiling wife insists I receive the largest portion of their meager meal. I sleep that night in a town whose name I will never learn, in a farmhouse that is not an inn, in the bed of a stranger who loves his neighbor.
That was From a Mountain Top by Jeff Thomas. My next favorite story was written by Virginia Ashbury. Virginia is no stranger to Life Rattle fans, as she is one of the producers of the Life Rattle show and had ably managed the show for a long time after Arnie Ackman's death in 2005. Here is her story, A Dinner and a Movie.
Dinner and a Movie by Virginia Ashbury. If I cry now, my eyes will puff, and then if he comes to the door, he'll know I was crying. Oh, damn it. This is so unfair. I can't cry because of him, for him, over him, or in spite of him. Let me start at the beginning. Fred works in the same building as me, but at a different unit. He's a sturdy-looking man, chunky graying patches in his thick brown hair, square dark-rimmed glasses, and good teeth. He wears only blue, any possible shade of blue. I've never seen anyone who dresses like this. Every day some new mix of Dockers, jeans, dress pants, sweaters, t-shirts, whatever, but all blue. When I first noticed this about Fred, I remembered hearing that Einstein wore the same outfit every day from a closet full of the same suits and shirts. Fred sits at a workstation cubicle beside my friend Grace. Grace and I meet for lunch on Fridays, and last week she suggests we drag Fred along. At Zelda's on Church Street, we order Eggs Benedict and Pina Coladas all round. Fred insists the mix of eggs and coconut rum is a gift from the gods, and damn it, he's right. We start telling jokes, then realize we all know Tom Lehrer's songs. Halfway through singing a fractured version of Poisoning Pigeons in the Park, we end snorting and gasping, choking on our drinks and lunch. We acted like obnoxious teenagers and may never be welcome back at Zelda's again. In the 6 months we've worked in the same building, I've never noticed Fred. But in the past week, every time I turn a corner, I run smack into him. On Wednesday morning, the collision is literal. "That's it," Fred almost yells. Putting his hands on my shoulders and holding me at arm's length, he looks straight at me and declares, "God is speaking to us. Do you like Chinese martial arts movies?" "No, not really," I reply, wondering what is his point. "Neither do I, so let's go see one. Okay, when? Is Friday too soon? I've read some of that book, The Rules, and I think I'm getting in under the wire here, he beams. Is it noon yet? I actually giggle. We'll grab dinner on Spadina after work, then we can walk over to the IMAX at John Street and catch that Crouching Tiger, Hidden Whatever movie. Cool, I say, hoping to sound like this is nothing out of the ordinary for me. I haven't had a date in 10 years. Oh, but I'll have to go home first and change. I almost snort at this. Blue is blue. What's the difference? I'll pick you up at your place, okay? Sure. You live in the Beaches, don't you? I say. My place is on the way downtown from there. I'll write out my address and phone number and drop it at your work at your desk later. Great. That's a deal, he says. For the rest of the week, whenever we see each other, we just nod and barely smile, like we have a secret to keep safe. Thursday, after work, I head directly to the Eaton Center. Starting at the north end, I race through all of the women's departments in virtually every store, hoping the perfect outfit will jump out at me. One that says, come hither, respect me, I'm comfortable with who I am, no strings, this is just a date, spend your life with me. Arriving at the South End food court, I consider finding a pack of razor blades and heading home. Air, that's what I need, I say directly to a 13-year-old with a cell phone glued to her ear. She just rolls her eyes and passes by. Out on Yonge Street, the twinkle and glare of thousands of watts of advertisements crowds out the darkness. With arms akimbo, I lean back and take 3 deep, cleansing breaths. Looking north, I can see the Cherokee store. Ah, I think, they never disappoint me. 20 minutes later, I have a pair of polar fleece pants and a matching turtleneck top, all soft and yielding, yet sturdy and blue. Getting home by 9:30, I dye my hair a new shade with mauve highlights. By midnight, I'm trying the new pants on with knee highs, then pantyhose, to figure which gives the best balance of seamless comfort. At 1 a.m., I realize I'm obsessing and go to bed. Arriving at work on Friday morning, I realize that I want to avoid Fred for the day. I'm hoping the evening will be separate from work, special, not just a continuation of what has become daily joking contact. My desk phone message light is blinking. The call is from Fred. He sounds unsteady, hesitant. He tells me that he won't be at work today. A family emergency has come up, but we're still on for tonight. I press the number 5 after the recording is over. The stilted mechanical voice tells me that the message was received at 2:25 a.m. from Fred's home number. I put this out of my mind. Really, it fits with what I wanted, doesn't it? By 5:45 p.m., I'm home and ready. That was 4 hours ago. I've rearranged my hair twice, put on makeup, then cleaned it off twice, paced, and made 3 calls to girlfriends who are not home. At 6:30, then again at 8 o'clock, I reach for the phone to call Grace, but stop myself. She will have personal information on Fred, insight into this callousness, but no, I will not risk becoming office gossip. So here I sit on the sofa, in contrived, formal posture, to gather my poise and composure, hands in my lap, forcing calm. Again, 3 deep breaths. Dignity, that's what I've lost. Monday will be hell. Picking up yesterday's Now magazine, I flip through the pages without attention. There, in the movie section, I see an advertisement for a midnight showing of Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. Yes. I have plenty of time to pick up an order of chicken fried rice on the way. I will sneak my dinner into the theater, slouch in the back row, and enjoy the extra elbow room. The plan was never for more than a dinner and a movie. I've lost nothing.
You just heard Virginia Ashbury and her story, A Dinner and a Movie. Our last story for tonight, and one also one of my favorites, was written by Monique Masabki. Monique works as a legal assistant at a downtown legal firm. Her family is from Schaumburg, a small town north of Toronto, and she is writing her first novel and also writes short stories on her blog under the pen name Monica Manning. Here now is Monique Masabki, I should not say that, and her story, Ma Mère Rosa.
Ma Mère Rosa by Monique Masabki. Our house sizzled with excitement whenever Ma Mère and Pépère announced they were coming for a visit. You could guarantee Ma Mère would bring two things with her from Sudbury: homemade date squares and money. The date squares were for me and my little brother, the money for playing cards. Every evening, once dinner was done, after the table was cleared and the dishes washed, the adults would regroup and play cards late into the evening. The game of choice was usually pinochle or euchre, and sometimes both, but always played for money. Not a lot of money, mind you, dimes and nickels, but money nonetheless. There's no point in playing cards if you're not playing for money. Ma Mère was firm on this. Even Yahtzee was played for money. Mom and Ma Mère spent the afternoons rolling dice, filling in the tiny squares on the score sheet, and exchanging coins. It should come as no surprise that, approaching 100, my grandmother still plays cards. And wins. Regularly. We're quite sure she cheats, but we haven't caught her in the act. She's a sly old bird. To celebrate Ma Mère's 99th birthday, the entire family gather at the nursing home. Her children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and one great-great-grandchild. 5 generations of rowdy French Canadians in one room. Quite a sight to behold. In the center of it all sits Ma Mère in her favorite rose-colored wing chair. Her back straight and knees together, she sits with her hands folded primly in her lap. She wears a royal blue dress and pink nail polish. Earrings wink at her lobes and a brooch sparkles below her left shoulder. She rests like a queen upon her throne, receiving her loyal subjects who bestow kisses on her paper-thin cheeks. If you think she is dressed for the occasion, you'd be wrong. This is how she dressed all the time. She always looks like she is ready for a party. Most often seen in a dress or a skirt, her hair and nails are always perfectly done. Even today, approaching 100, she is dressed for visitors, including earrings and an ever-present brooch. I watch Ma Mère as she sits in her chair. In her gnarled hands, she clutches a small white leather pouch. I know immediately what it is, for I have one just like it. It doesn't surprise me that she is holding it today. Ma Mère attended Mass every Sunday without fail, and still receives communion each week from the visiting priest at the nursing home. My own white leather pouch, embossed with a gold cross, sits in my dresser drawer at home. Inside it is the pink rosary Ma Mère made for me for my first Holy Communion. Ma Mère is alone for a moment, and her sharp eyes wander over the group until they come to rest on me. Her mouth curves up in a serene smile, and she winks. I excuse myself from a conversation with my dad and Cousin Sue and wander over. Kneeling in front of Ma Mère, I lay my smooth hand over her wrinkled, crooked fingers. I glance down at the white leather pouch clutched reverently in her hands. "What's in the pouch, Ma Mère?" I gesture with my chin at her hands. I know she says her rosary quite regularly. I imagine the string of beads in her white leather pouch are worn from years of use, and I want to see them again. I want to hold those ancient beads in my hand as she has done so many times before me. Ma Mère leans forward, her eyes sparkling with excitement. "There's a lot of people here today." She glances around the room at her family, I nod my head, prompting her to continue. We might play cards later. I'm ready. She gives the white leather pouch a little shake, and rather than hearing the expected tinkle of rosary beads clinking together, I hear the distinct jingle of coins bouncing against each other. A wide grin splits across my face, and I think to myself, I want to be just like her when I grow up.
And that was Ma Mère Rosa, written and read by Monique Masabki. And that's our show for tonight. Please tune in again on Sunday, August 21st, for our last show here on CKLN. And of course, Life Rattle will continue to air stories on its website. You can listen to our podcasts at www.liferattle.ca. And that concludes Life Rattle number 1165. Virginia Ashbury recorded Jeff Thomas and Monique Masabki reading their stories. Arnie Ackman recorded Virginia Ashbury recording her story. My name is Victoria Martinez, and Life Rattle returns on Sunday night for its final show at 9 o'clock. You would not want to miss it. Life Rattle is produced from Ryerson University in Toronto and was created by Guy Allen and Arnie Ackman. Good night, everybody. Thank you.